May it please the court, Michael Abel on behalf of Linwood Ely. Good morning, Your Honors. The case we have at bar is essentially dealing with constructive possession and how the court, I guess, later interpreted and clarified constructive possession in Lacates, which was before this case actually went to trial. And unfortunately, I think if we had it at the time, it would have added some clarity and we probably wouldn't have to be here today. What happened in the case of Mr. Ely is that during the course of the trial, it became apparent that the state's theory for constructive possession of a firearm was going to have to rely, possession was going to have to rely on constructive possession. At the time, although constructive possession was well established for drugs, when it comes into the neighborhood of firearms, I don't believe that there was a specific case that pointed out the constructive possession elements for guns as well as they've been specifically delineated in for drugs, in which the court clarified in Lacates. So when this case came about, the presiding judge decided that the constructive possession elements for guns were different for drugs. At the time of trial, it was specifically requested that the words intended to guide the destiny of the gun be included in the jury instruction. Now, I'm aware that in Clayton, the court decided that those specific words did not need to be put in there as long as the point got across that the person who was being charged with the crime had some intentions of acting upon the firearm in question. Later, there was also a specific problem raised by the defense in the jury instruction, which I'll read. Constructive possession means that the deadly weapon was within the defendant's reasonable control. That is, it was about his person, premises, belongings, or vehicle. In other words, the defendant had constructive possession over the deadly weapon if he had both the power and the intention at a given time to exercise control over the deadly weapon, either directly or through another. Now, that direction by itself can lead a jury, although it tends to be, I think, a little ambiguous, that intention is an element.
what's ambiguous about it?
Well, I think the words, and I think this is what hung the court up the most, was at a given time. If you look through this, I believe that the court, as well as the state, argued that that given time need not have happened yet. With the specific three elements that were put in, as it was quoted in Thomas in your Lacates decision, that, you know, in order to find it, you must show that the defendant knew the location of the drugs, because that was a drug case, that the defendant had the ability to exercise dominion control, and three, had the intention to guide their destiny.
Well, if you look at the facts of this case, I understand there's somewhat of a dispute, but it appears the sister wanted the gun out of her other premises. She said to her brother, who was on the lease, "Would you take care of this so my son doesn't get near it?" And he said, "You've got to keep it in your bedroom." And she, you know, came forward and said, "It's my gun, it's my bedroom, I keep it locked." When you're talking about him having control over what happens to the gun, an argument could be made based on this record. He said, "You can have the gun in my house, but this is the only place you can keep it." So why wouldn't that indicate he was in charge of where the gun would be kept within his house?
I think the problem with that argument, Your Honor, is that...
No, it's a question.
Oh, sorry, with that question. I think the problem with that scenario is that, do you immediately assume possession on someone who says that they don't want something near them? If you were to say, you know, "Keep those drugs out of my house," you've directed them away from you. You have, but you haven't taken possession of them yourself.
But the difference here is he didn't say, "I'm a convicted felon, I'm a person prohibited, I don't want a gun on my premises." He said, "If you want to keep the gun on my premises, you have to keep it in your bedroom."
I understand that, and I think that if we, And I understand, but I think that goes more into the argument of, did he have knowledge of it? And I think clearly he had knowledge of it. Now, did he want it around him specifically? No. And I can understand where it's possible maybe the state could make that argument that this is circumstantial evidence that he wanted it near him. I think that that's a tough argument, and I think that's weak evidence. But I can see where Your Honor's coming from, and they could potentially make that argument.
Well, didn't he exercise dominion over it in the sense of directing where in his house it would be hidden?
I think in a sense, but as I stated before, when you're saying, when your intention is saying keep it as far away from me and as far out of my control at the same time, then I think, like I said, I think the state could make an argument that based on these circumstances specifically, that he did have dominion and control. However, when that control is saying keep it away from me, I don't want to have anything to do with it, I think it's a tough argument to make. And maybe you can go to the jury in that fashion. However, in this case, all of those arguments are entirely negated by the prosecutor's argument in closing argument, where the prosecutor specifically states, the state doesn't have to prove that he intended to exercise control of the gun, just that he could because it was there.
Was there any instruction given, I know this has been done before, where a judge would tell the jury, I'm going to instruct you on the law. If the attorneys argue anything inconsistent with what I say, then what I say is controlling.
Well, the problem with that in this case, and...
Well, was that done first?
I couldn't honestly recall. But the problem with it in this case specifically is that we had been having this argument all day about the jury instructions and does the state need to prove intent. And in my closing argument, I was objected to because I stated that the state needs to prove intent, that he had to intend to have it with him at some time.
Have we moved to another argument now? Have you passed your concern over whether or not there is sufficient evidence to establish that he intended to exercise dominion and control over the gun? Now we're getting to whether the prosecutor intentionally misrepresented what he knew to be the instruction of the court?
Yes, Your Honor, okay. If that's okay with Your Honor. And what specifically happened is I was objected to, and Judge Graves allowed me to finalize that argument and did not give a curative on that. But then he allowed the prosecutor to state that he doesn't need to prove that there was any intent. And because it had been so contentious over this, instead of doing what I should have done, which was ask for a sidebar, I stood up and I said, Your Honor, that was a misstatement of what you just said in front of the jury. And that was my mistake. I know proper etiquette.
Why is that a mistake?
In Sussex County, Your Honor, you don't make any objections in front of the jury. You go up to sidebar to talk about everything. So as far as the decorum in the court in Sussex County, that's not how you do it.
You stood up and said what you said during the prosecutor's closing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, if you don't, where does that leave you?
Well, I would typically object and then go to sidebar and the judge would rule from there. But what I'm saying gives it exceptional power in this one. As I said, that was a misstatement of what you just said, and Judge Graves said, no, it wasn't. So at that point, Judge Graves confirmed that the prosecutor's argument was correct, that they didn't have to prove intent in this case. And I don't believe it's disputed that some form of intent is necessary.
All right, well, that goes to what the prosecutor should or shouldn't have said. But when the trial judge gave the instructions, he gave the instruction you just read to us, didn't he, which included the element of intent?
Sort of. If he would have given the three caveats of the defendant needed to know the location, the defendant had the ability to exercise dominion and control, and had the intention to guide their destiny, I think it would have been a lot clearer. But he didn't give the guide the destiny. It was denied over my repeated request to do that. So I think when you say, you know, if he had the power and the intention at a given time, and then the prosecutor argues, we don't have to show intention.
Well, are we examining his failure to add the third intended to guide the destiny of the gun phrase in terms of what the law was at the time or what the law is now?
I think the law was the same. I don't believe that there has been a modification.
Well, then maybe I don't understand your argument. I thought your argument just was this instruct that the jury had to find that he intended to exercise dominion and control over the weapon was not enough. He had to flesh it out in, with three elements, one of those which guide the destiny of the gun. And you acknowledged, as I think we all know, that we later explained that language is just meant to be illustrative of how one might demonstrate the intent to exercise dominion and control, and wasn't a mandated phrase in order to give the perfect instruction. So where are we in terms of whether the judge erred or not in his instruction?
I think it's a compound problem. I think if the state had not made this argument that intent was not possible, intent was not required, and that perhaps the instruction with intended to guide the destiny was in there, then maybe it's possible they could look through that and decide, you know, just from the instructions clearly that it was. But when you look at intention and then put after it at a given time, which it's my belief that it was the prosecutor's belief and the judge's belief that at a given time could be sometime in the future.
Well, what was the word intent a defined term as it might have been if it was used in a contract? In other words, specifically described to the jury? Or was the jury left with their common understanding of that word in the English language?
It was not specifically defined.
Okay.
Well, help me understand the temporal aspect of your argument. Are you suggesting that at the time the police searched the premises, the gun was in the sister's bedroom, and he had no connection to the gun, therefore, at the time they were searching the house, he couldn't have been found guilty of possession by a person prohibited? Is your argument that narrow? And if it is, you seem to be concerned that to the extent he permitted it to be in his house and he permitted it to be in his sister's bedroom, at any point in time, he could have exercised control of the gun, and that that general ability to do something in the future is an incorrect statement of the law, that the only focus in this case should have been on the proximity between him and the gun at the time of the search.
I think to answer your first question, that I don't believe it's that narrow, that nobody in the position of having a gun found in their house can be found of constructive possession. I think under the facts of this case that were given, that he could not have been found guilty of that. But I'm not saying that as a total rule, it's got to be found on you. That would destroy constructive possession.
And what's the relevance of the time of the search? Is that relevant to your argument at all?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, the second.
And my second question was, if at some time in the future he could have exercised control or guided the destiny of the gun, why wouldn't he be guilty of possession by a person prohibited?
Because I don't think that this state or any other state punishes crimes that have not occurred yet. I mean, I think you get on the slippery slope of, and I believe I used the argument in my brief, if I am a person prohibited and I know that Walmart sells guns, and maybe they won't sell them directly to me because they check my ID, but I could go into that store and say, can I take a look at that rifle? I could be a person prohibited right now.
The logical extension of your argument is, if you're a person prohibited and you have a residence, it's all right to know that there are guns somewhere in your residence. That's not a problem.
That is. I think that there has to be another step. And I believe the state could have proved it circumstantially. I don't believe they did in this case. But I think that you can, such as if somebody said, hey, will you buy me a gun and keep it up there for protection. I don't want to use it, but I want to know that it's there. Then maybe there's evidence of that.
Is there any, keeping in mind Justice Holland's question about the temporal nature of the offense, is there any significance to the fact that the sister testified that this was a bedroom she shared with someone else, even though it was on his premises, and it was locked all the time, and there were only two keys? She and her boyfriend were the only ones with the keys. Yet when the police arrived, the door was unlocked, and they testified as much. Is there any significance to that distinction between it was locked, it wasn't locked?
Well, I think
in terms of his ability to exercise dominion and control?
Well, the problem is we don't know how it was before the police came. I mean, when the police come barging in at 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, and there was quite a disturbance because Mr. Ely at first was not somebody on probation and was not welcoming them into his home, I would suspect that Juan Carlos, who was in the other bedroom, opened up the door and came out to see what was going on. So I don't think it's necessarily inconsistent, but we don't know for sure what was occurring when that in fact happened.
Well, Justice Holland has yet to ask a hypothetical, so I'm going to ask a hypothetical. So assume you run a boarding house and you're renting rooms. You know someone who's renting the room for you, has their own separate key, and you learn that they possess a weapon. You, the lessor of that room, don't have immediate access to the room, although you have control of the premises, theoretically, and you know there's a gun there. Is that situation different than this one?
I think that with the different circumstances, I think it all would end up going to the weight of the evidence should the state attempt to prove constructive possession. I think clearly the evidence would be lighter against somebody in that same circumstance with a boarding house than if you're in a smaller residence, but I still think it
goes. So you would let that go to the jury and let the jury decide?
I think so.
That's what happened here, isn't it?
Not exactly. Not when the prosecutor says intent isn't required at all. That's the problem, and as I stated before.
Well, that's what I'm trying to sort through, whether this case turns on the question of whether the prosecutor intentionally misrepresented the jury's upcoming instruction in a way that was designed to confuse the jury and lessen his burden, or whether the case turns on the textbook definition of what it takes to establish constructive possession of a weapon beyond a reasonable doubt. What is the case all about? Either or both of those issues?
I think if the jury in this case, with the argument that the prosecutor made, which was basically affirmed by Judge Graves after my objection, the jury had no opportunity to look at the facts, because we did not dispute that Mr. Ely knew the gun was there. And as the prosecutor argued, he actually argued it was not a steel door, and even if it was locked, it could be kicked in. Under those circumstances, Mr. Ely knew that the gun was there, and he could possibly kick this door open. So under those circumstances, and Judge Graves affirming that intent is not necessary, the jury had no...
But he ultimately gave the instruction, correct?
No.
That intent, that if he had both the power and the intention at a given time to exercise control, that instruction was given, correct?
Yes, sir.
So even if he erred in overruling your objection, why isn't it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, since the jury was ultimately instructed correctly?
Because I believe that instruction, given as it was, is not clear enough without the extra caveats of the intention to guide the destiny or something like that.
Well,
that
that's made the pattern instruction, which is a correct statement of the law, isn't it?
But the pattern instruction typically has those three caveats on the end of what you need to find. And in this case, it wasn't there. So that's my problem, is it wasn't as specific where you could look at it and disregard an argument. It was.
Are you sure on that the pattern instruction has control of the destiny language in it?
When I was reviewing Lacates.
Well, I'm not saying what's in Lacates. I'm saying the Superior Court pattern instruction.
I believe it was, if my recollection is correct, it was removed because Judge Graves viewed guns and drugs differently. I believe it would be in the pattern instruction. I didn't get the pattern instruction. I got it as it was ultimately read. But I believe he removed it because he did not view guns and drugs in the same manner.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Sure. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Abby Adams on behalf of the State of Delaware. Your Honors, Delaware law does not permit a person prohibited to hold a firearm and ammunition for another person. Ely was previously convicted of attempted assault as a lesser-included offense of attempted murder. He is exactly the person to whom the prohibition in Section 1448 should apply, and there was ample evidence to find him in constructive possession of that firearm. At trial, two different officers testified that when the gun was found, Ely tried to explain the weapon was not his and that it actually belonged to his sister, and he had taken it from her for her safekeeping because of her young child. That was Officer Mumford. Detective Whitelock explained something related to the, Ely said, something related to the fact that it was his sister's firearm and it was turned over to him at the house to keep him, keep it away from his nephew. In his later police interview, Ely said, the sister put it in his house because she was getting ready to move to a different apartment. Quote, I didn't want it in my room because the girlfriend was on probation, so we told Carlos to put it in his room. We told Carlos to put it in his room. Later, the sister goes to the police station and then to JP Court about the gun, and she gave her address not as that apartment, but as her mother's house. And at trial, among other things, she did testify that she asked permission of Ely, and Ely agreed to keep the gun there and said, as long as she keeps it locked in her room. That's at B-112. On the stand, Ely testified that he was holding the gun for his sister. Quote, so she asked me if it was okay, and I told her I can't be around a gun, and I told her it has to be in her room, and she has to get a lock on the door. And it goes on. Several times he states the same thing. She asked me if I could hold it for her. I told her she had to keep it locked. All of these things are evidence of his intent to control, intent to exercise dominion and control over that gun, because he is directing where it is being kept in that apartment.
Even if he's directing it to be kept away from him and locked, that's, that you interpret to be his intention to have dominion and exercise dominion and control over the gun?
He was asked permission to keep it there, and yes, because he directed, you lock it. It's reasonable to infer that he could have simply said, go get me the gun, and the gun would have been in his hands.
Well, I'm confused, because it strikes me, with a little dash of common sense, that if he intended to exercise dominion and control, he would say, you can keep it in your room, but keep it unlocked so I can have access to it when I need it. Not keep it locked because I'm not supposed to have a gun around me. There's a certain inconsistency there, isn't there?
In both situations, though, he is directing where the gun is kept. So it is not inconsistent with his intent to have dominion and control over this gun, because he's saying keep it in the locked room, and that's only if viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the state, first of all, that door wasn't locked. But if you...
Well, was there someone in the bedroom?
At the time the gun was found, there was someone in the bedroom, okay. Yes.
Makes sense to you that if someone's in the bedroom and the gun belongs to them, that they don't see a need to lock the door, but they lock the door when they leave so no one else can have access to the gun?
I think the testimony was that, according to Ely and his sister, that the door was purportedly locked at all times, although Ely testified he never tried the door to see whether it was locked. Even when, I think the sister testified that even when she was there,
is there a meaningful distinction between locking a door when you leave the premises to protect your possessions from being taken from someone else and leaving it unlocked when you're actually in the room and can have some physical control over your possessions?
In this case, that distinction doesn't affect whether Ely had intent to have dominion and control over this gun. Whether or not Carlos locked the door, Ely still had directed
the gun. Well, it doesn't affect where Ely had directed the gun to be kept. The question still remains, directing his sister to keep it in his room and locked away from him, is that or is that not consistent with the view that he intended to exercise dominion and control over it?
Well, there is a slight distinction in Your Honor's question, because Ely, there's no testimony that Ely ever said, don't ever give me this gun. He said, keep it locked in your room. The reasonable inference is that he could have said, go get me the gun, and it would be obtained for him.
But I thought you indicated earlier that he explained the rationale for that, that he couldn't be in possession of a gun, and he was concerned and worried over that. So if she was going to keep it, she needed to keep it away from him, and preferably locked up. Does that sound like the kind of person that the law intends to punish because they're prohibited from having a gun? A person that says, okay, sister, not stranger, but sister, if you want to keep the gun away from my nephew, you can keep it here, but keep it locked and away from me. Is that the kind of person that looks like to you that they intend to break the law?
He was breaking the law because he allowed the gun to be there, and he told her where to put it, and he never said, keep it away from me. I understand the court's, and respectfully, Your Honor, I understand your position that his explanation.
Well, it's not my position, it's just my question, but is it a malum prohibitum or malum in se crime? Is it like driving a car with an expired registration? It doesn't matter that you didn't know it was expired, you're still going to be found guilty?
No, it's definitely an intent crime. There had to be his intent to have dominion and control over that weapon.
Okay, if I understood your explanation of the facts, this is a case where a man says to his own sister, for the protection of his own nephew, yet you can have the gun while you're staying here, but keep it in your room and locked away from me, because I'm not supposed to be in possession of a gun. Is that the classic example of a person prohibited who's found in possession of a weapon?
It is not the classic example. However, in the question, there are several inferences that aren't presumed in favor of the state. They're presuming the defense's position on what was happening there. The state maintains that...
I thought I was just tracking what you said to us that were facts.
The sister was not living there. Viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the state, the sister was not living there. That night, she gave an address that was other than that house. That search was on a Wednesday night at 12 o'clock, approximately midnight. She was not at the house. That night, Ely said, we told Carlos to put it in his room. If the sister had been living there, it seems reasonable he would have said, I told her to put it in her room. He told Carlos to put the gun in his room. So there's several facts there that aren't taken in the light most favorable to the state. The state maintains that she was not living there and that he was directing where that gun is kept for her.
As a general proposition, what's the state's view with regard to whether a person prohibited can ever permit a gun to be in the general residence owned by or leased by the person prohibited? Or is that always going to be a crime, or are there some circumstances where you can distance yourself from the gun even though it's in your residence and not be guilty of a crime?
That would not always be a crime. There are circumstances where a person who rents, leases, owns the house, there could be a gun in the house, and that person still is not intending to exercise dominion and control over the gun. The hypothetical that the Chief Justice provided with the rental situation, where in that case, the landlord didn't grant permission for that lessee to have the gun on those premises, but it was there. In that situation, it would likely be that there was no intent to exercise dominion and control over the gun. If the gun was locked in a more secure safe, perhaps, that no one had the combination to except its owner, there are situations where a gun could be found on this premises and there was no intent by the person prohibited.
So if it turns on intent, didn't the jury receive inconsistent messages from the judge in this case?
The jury instructions were correct in this case. And the jury, to answer your earlier question, was specifically instructed to follow the written instructions on the law. And if they had questions on the law, to ask the court. And there were no questions asked, but they were specifically instructed to follow the written instructions.
But were they also told that the state was not required to improve intent?
The state's argument really needs to be looked at in context. This case was 4 months before Lacates, and it was a year before Clayton. The prosecutor got through his entire closing following the jury instructions that were given in this case. And those instructions matched the jury instructions that were given in Thomas, which in Lacates, this court said, were correct instructions. Or that Thomas had the law correct on possession with respect to a firearm. The prosecutor got through his entire closing argument following those instructions. In the defense closing, Defense counsel then stated, and the same sort of argument defense counsel raises today, defense counsel essentially argued that Ely had to have the intent or want the firearm for himself at that time. Defense added sort of an extra element of intent, a higher level of intent that was inconsistent with the jury instruction. And after that, the state came back with a counter to try to explain what it thought was the appropriate instruction at the time. Defense said Mr. Ely would have to have both the power and the intention to have it. And that was in the context of, let's say Mr. Ely was there when the door was unlocked. Could he have gone there and gotten it? Sure. But did he have the intention? You've heard nothing to lead you to believe that there was any intent on behalf of Mr. Ely. If he walked, and then he gives the sporting goods illustration again, and he said later, why would he tell his sister to put it in Carlos' bedroom? Is to act the act of someone who intentionally wants that firearm. Defense counsel was arguing in a way that Ely had to have the intent to have the firearm for himself, not just to hold it for his sister or to have it there so it's not at his sister's house.
Well, isn't that what the instruction says? Intention at a given time to exercise control over the deadly weapon?
But it's the intent to want it for himself that defense counsel was arguing. Not, I think it's different than the instruction, which the intent is to exercise dominion and control over the firearm. He can be keeping it for his sister and not have the intent to have it for himself.
And do you have the prosecutor's argument there in front of you?
Yes.
What did the prosecutor argue?
Well, after the defense counsel gave that instruction, there was an objection. The Superior Court again gave the correct jury instruction to the jury, and then the prosecutor started his rebuttal argument, and he said, and to the end of the jury instructions, the Superior Court stated, what the sentence is basically saying is if at any given time he intended to obtain control of the gun, he had the power to do so. That was the Superior Court. And then the state began his rebuttal. Accordingly, the state does not have to prove that he intended to exercise control of the gun, just that he could get it because it was there. Without the benefit of Lacates and Clayton, the argument is not clear, yes. But it is a good faith argument based on the law at the time. Prosecutor is trying to say that Ely only had to have the ability to control the gun and the intent to, it's closer to that than the opening of the statement believes. The defense counsel did object, and then the state argued again. The state does not have to prove that Mr. Ely ever intended the possession.
Well, doesn't ability just translate into proximity? I mean, anything that's in proximity, you presumably have the ability to go get.
Not necessarily, because ability would then also turn on whether it was locked, whether it was in a safe, whether it was behind a locked room. Like, there are a lot of things that just aren't proximity as far as ability. So the two elements are different. I mean, in hindsight, with the benefit of Lacates and Clayton, the prosecutor's argument is at worst a misstatement, but it definitely was not intentional. And the jury did get the
incorrect... Well, the statement was intentional.
I'm sorry. Yes.
I assume you mean that the way he phrased his argument, he did not intend to contradict or appear to contradict the instruction of the court.
Right.
Okay.
Definitely not. The Superior Court did overrule the defense defense objection.
And saying that, the trial judge said what? Overruled or said did not have to prove intent?
He said, I believe he said disagree, and then the state continued.
I'm sorry, what did he say?
I believe the Superior Court said disagree, and then the state continued.
So what's the state's position with regard to what they proved in this case regarding Ely's intent? We discussed earlier that you can be a person prohibited and have a gun somewhere in your residence in circumstances that negate the intent under the statute to be a crime. What was Ely's intent that was established in this case to constitute the crime?
Ely's intent was to hold this weapon for his sister and direct where it be held. It was only because of Ely that that gun was locked. He could have easily directed it to be anywhere else in that apartment. He formed that intent to exercise dominion over and control over that weapon from the minute it came into his house until the police, and it continued until the police found the weapon. Your Honor, the state submits that there was ample evidence, particularly viewed in the light most favorable of the state, there was ample evidence to find Ely guilty of possession, constructive possession of the firearm and the ammunition.
Can you just explain to me again, so I want to be sure I follow it. With regard to the emphasis on the written instructions that you say the trial judge gave, how would that, let's assume that an inference could be drawn from the earlier statement of the trial judge that intent did not have to be, was not an element, and the instructions contradict that. What clear signal was given to the jury that the instructions overrode anything that was said earlier?
The jury was instructed, if you have questions on the law, go first to the instructions. I'll send several copies back. If you still have questions concerning the law, write that question out. If it is a question on the law, I will attempt to answer it. If it is something I can't answer, I will bring you back and address you. That was the jury instruction that occurred one page before the state started its closing argument. The instruction on the law that was given was the exact instruction given in Thomas, and in Lacates, this court said that Thomas was the correct statement of the law of constructive possession with respect to a firearm. There is nothing to indicate that the jury had any questions beyond those written instructions. And in Money, this court said that even where the prosecutor made a misstatement of the law, the fact that the jury had the correct instructions cured the issue. The jury is presumed to follow those instructions, and the conviction stood in Money, and it should stand here.
So you're saying that in Lacates we approved the instruction in Thomas and that the Thomas instruction was given in this case?
Yes, comparing the case of Thomas, I didn't go back and look at the specific instruction, but it's quoted in Thomas. It was the same instruction here. It was slightly reworded.
Well, I guess the only troublesome issue that remains on that part of the case is it's one thing to say the case law says the instructions can cure an inadvertent misstatement by the prosecutor in the heat of giving a closing. But in this case, there's the added ingredient of the trial judge agreeing with that misstatement in the midst of the closing and then giving something contradictory. And I'm a bit confused. Is this one of these bizarre modern approaches where the instructions given before the closing, or was the instructions given after the closing?
The instructions were given before the closing. The state submits that if you look at all of that discussion and the instructions in context, it was not so far away, even when the Superior Court agreed, it was not so far away from what the jury instruction was saying.
Okay, I just want to make sure I understand this. The last thing the jury heard was the prosecutor in rebuttal saying the state didn't have to establish intent, and heard the trial judge confirm that, even though he had given an instruction to the contrary beforehand. Is that how this played out?
Yes.
Okay. So, to the extent the jury remembered the instruction and thought they understood it, one might say that the ruling on the objection could have been viewed by the jury as a clarification of the earlier instruction.
My time is out.
Please answer the question. Yeah.
The jury was instructed to follow the written instructions, and they had a copy of the written instructions, and they were specifically told, if you have any questions, to ask those questions. I understand Your Honor's question that it could be viewed as a clarification of the instructions. However, still viewed in the context of this entire case, that instruction is not so far off of the written jury instruction. Not having the benefit of looking at Lacates, if you read what the prosecutor said, looking at Lacates and Clayton, it definitely sounds confusing at best. However, without the benefit of that and just viewing the jury instructions themselves, it was not so far off, because what they're trying to get at is the idea, what they're really getting at is his intent to exercise dominion and control over the weapon, even though it basically doubles back on itself, the sentence. That's what they're basically trying to get at. The bottom line is that the jury instruction, the written jury instruction, was very clear, and there was overwhelming evidence of that intent in this case.
I'd like, if I may, ask a question about the process. Were the jury given the written instruction to follow along as the judge read it before the closing argument?
No. I don't believe they had copies until they went to the jury room.
Right. And then when they were given copies after the conclusion of the arguments, was there any additional advice given? Here are the instructions that I referred to earlier that you're to follow, or anything like that?
I believe after the state finished its rebuttal, the jury left for the day and came back the next day. I know they came back the next day to deliberate. And I'm not sure if there was any additional instruction given when they came back to deliberate.
This is the first appeal that I've ever participated in where the instructions were given before the closing arguments. And based on your experience or knowledge, is this the trend?
Based on my experience, I believe this is the first case that I've noticed all the instructions being given before the closing arguments. Based on my limited experience, I'm not sure if it is the standard way that that particular Superior Court judge does this in Sussex County. I couldn't say.
So given the fact that the prosecutor has both an opening and a rebuttal closing, before the jury retires to deliberate, the last interpretation of the law to be applied to the facts in the case, they will hear from the prosecutor.
Yes, Your
Honor. Not the independent, neutral, detached magistrate, but from the prosecutor.
But as they're instructed, and as this court pointed out in Money, the statements by counsel in closing are argument and not factual evidence or legal pronouncement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I may briefly clarify something. It is the standard practice that Judge Graves reads the jury instructions before closing argument. In this matter, there was quite a bit of discussion. It was at the end of the day. We came back.
Make sure I understand it. That's Judge Graves' practice, not the standard practice.
Judge Graves' practice tends to sway the practice at being the resident judge in Sussex County, so that tends to be the practice.
But doesn't the rule address this about instruction?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Doesn't the rule address the discretion to give instructions either before or after closing argument, at least in civil cases?
I don't believe that there's a problem with it, Your Honor. I mean, in this case, I think there is because of the big dispute we had. And in this case, actually putting an issue of law before the jury instead of an issue of fact. But I don't think it has to be that way. As far as I'm aware, Your Honor, I don't think that there's an issue there. I just wanted to clarify the Chief Justice's question of if this is the standard practice of how it occurs in Sussex County. And if I may, I'm sorry.
We'll give you 1 minute. The prosecutor had some more time, and we questioned you before you had a word out of your mouth, so go ahead, 1 minute.
To clarify some other questions, the objection that after the prosecutor got up in his rebuttal, my objection was that was a misstatement of what you just said, which I said to Judge Graves, and Judge Graves said, I don't think so. So he directly affirmed the prosecutor's comment that they didn't have to exercise control of the gun. And although this was not in front of the jury, the state today is trying to argue that there was some more general intent. The prosecutor specifically said to the judge, the state does not need to prove that he intended to get the gun, only that it's there. There's no gray area of if it was some general intent. their argument was approximation. If it's around and he could possibly get it, it's his gun, which is a ridiculous argument.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.